Jesus came into town on a Palm Sunday. On Monday, he was giving parables. He gave parables about a son or sons. He would go to Lazarus's, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus's house in Bethany, and then come back to town. His first parable, which we were able to look at last time, a father had two sons. One said he would not obey the father, and then later did. The other one lied the whole time. He said he was going to do what is right. From the start, he lied. To the finish, he lied. The son who first disobeyed but later obeyed the father was like the tax collectors and the prostitutes. They started out disobeying God, but did believe in John the Baptist in a lot of cases, and did believe John the Baptist said that Jesus was the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. So they started out bad, but did what was right in the end. But the listeners, the Sadducees, they disobeyed following Jesus from beginning to end. The next parable was about Israel. Israel is God's vineyard or grape field. Isaiah 5 teaches so, and Jesus quoted Isaiah chapter 5. The caretakers of the vineyard of Israel killed all the servants that God sent them. Then he sent the son, and they were going to kill him too. And then Jesus asked, what will the father do to them? Well, the answer, even from the critics, is he will give them a miserable end. And Jesus quoted Psalm 118 about the cornerstone. Jesus is the cornerstone for all who believe in him. He's like the foundation of life. But he will be like a pulverizing stone, crashing down and grinding to dust all those who will not trust in him, like most of his listeners. Now we will get to Matthew 22. It's another parable, parable number 3. Did not have time to get to it last week. It's about an invitation to a wedding. The father invites people to come to the son's wedding. And a lot of people in the beginning, they're going to make excuses and they're not going to come. We're at Matthew 22 in the first section. Verses 1 through 7. Jesus spoke to them again in parables, cast alongside of, saying, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. And he sent out his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding feast, and they were unwilling to come. Then he sent out other slaves, saying, tell those who have been invited, behold, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen and my fatted livestock, all are butchered, and everything is ready, come to the wedding feast. But they paid no attention, went their way, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his slaves and mistreated them, killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his armies and destroyed those murderers and set their city on fire. The church is illustrated over and over again as the bride. Therefore, references here to the wedding guests don't refer to the church. They don't refer to Christians. We are the bride of Christ. We are not the wedding guests. The wedding guests in Matthew 22, he was talking to the Jewish leaders. At the time he was talking, the Old Testament worship system was still in operation. So he's talking about many Jewish people had been invited to come to the Messiah, come to the wedding feast, and they had refused. The parallel in Luke 14 gives all kinds of really lame excuses. In Luke 14, I have bought some farmland. I need to go look at it. Like, wouldn't you go look into the place before you bought it? Or, I have bought 10 oxen. I have to go look at them. Well, that's a lame excuse. And the worst excuse was, I am married. I can't come to a wedding. That's actually in Luke 14. These are really lame excuses. And in this parable, they're not going to come to the wedding, and the messengers that are sent with invitation, some are beaten, some are killed, like John the Baptist at the time. What will he do? The king will set the city on fire. Well, he's talking to them, and the Romans burned Jerusalem and the temple on August 10th, AD 70. And so literally, the city was set on fire. And that's probably why Jesus made this reference at this time. So in the next section, he goes to the non-wealthy people, the non-elite, the ordinary people, and they get invited. So let's read the next section, verse 8 and following. Then he said to his slaves, "The wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Go therefore to the main highways, and as many as you can find, invite them to the wedding feast." Those slaves went out into the streets and gathered together all they found, both evil and good. And the wedding hall, big convention center, was filled with dinner guests. We have a song, "Make Me a Blessing," out on the highways and byways of life. Just go everywhere, invite anybody who will come to Jesus and come to the wedding feast, invite anybody, let them come. And some did. Some had been good in their past, some had been bad in their past. A little better to be good, but the important thing was coming to Jesus. That's the important thing, the decision to come to the Son. In the closing section, some want to go to the wedding, but they don't want forgiveness first. They don't want forgiveness by trusting in Jesus, and they thought they'll be able to go to the wedding and they'll be able to go to heaven. Well, that's verses 11 through 14. The king came in to look over the dinner guests. He saw a man there who was not dressed in wedding clothes. And he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes?" And the man was speechless. And the king said to his servants, "Bind him hand and foot and throw him into outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen." In the book of Revelation, there are white robes in heaven. In Revelation 6:11, it talks about the martyrs who will be killed in a future tribulation period. And they're up in heaven and they have all these white robes on. In Revelation 19:8, there are Christians up in heaven, and it's getting ready to talk about Jesus' second coming. But the armies in heaven, the believers that follow him, are, quote, in fine linen, white and clean. So here is a picture of you are welcome to the wedding, and you have been forgiven, and you have these robes on. In Jesus' parable, there is a person who wants to go to the king's feast, wants to go into the kingdom, but does not have clean attire. It is interesting here that who is talking to are the Sadducees, and the Sadducees did not believe in life after death. Well, that's really odd to say you're head of the temple in those days and did not believe in life after death. Now, in my Bible, it's on the same page. It's verse 23. And we're not going to get to verse 23 this time. But verse 23, on that day, Sadducees, quote, who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus. The Sadducees did not believe in life after death. Really, really odd. They ran the temple. They liked all these religious trappings and get-togethers and parties and events. But they were really liberal. They did not believe in life after death. So one of the things here is Jesus is kind of telling them there will be life after death. And unless they trust in the Son, they will be in outer darkness. There will be life after death, but there also will be punishment after death for those that don't get forgiveness from Jesus. But there will be life after death. Here the stress is on a place that is dark. Later, coming in Matthew 25:40, Jesus will talk about a place of eternal fire. So when I think of darkness, it doesn't fit with fire unless there's a lot of blindness. So that's kind of how I put them together, because it's going to be outer darkness and yet a place of eternal burning, but they can't see anything, and that's why it must be dark. There are people today who do not believe in a place of future punishment, but Jesus taught it. What is the most odd is people who say that they will believe in Jesus, but they don't believe what Jesus taught about the afterlife. But 11 of the 12 references of Gehenna in the Bible are from Jesus. So Gehenom, the valley, it was outside of Jerusalem, that was like a garbage dump, and it burned all the time. So that's Gehenna was what Jesus called this place of eternal punishment. The Sadducees do not believe in life after death, but Jesus did. We have a reference here to cast out of the kingdom. I thought it would be good to put in the reverse. John 6:37, all who come to me, I will in no way cast out. Those who come to Jesus will not be cast out. Here is a reference to some who would be cast out. And in earlier reference to the cornerstone, cast out but smashed, pulverized, ground up. The liberal Sadducees will stop for a while. They're going to come back like we saw in verse 23. They're still standing around, but they're going to stop for a while. And now we come to the next section about the Pharisees. Jesus had just turned over the banking tables. Was Jesus against paying taxes? Was Jesus against the Romans? So maybe we can trap him in this. So that's what's coming up. But before we read the actual challenge, we want to read about the hypocritical introduction. And we'll just take verses 15 and 16, because really a hypocritical introduction. Verse 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted together how they might trap him in what he said. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodian, saying, Teacher, we know you are truthful and teach the way of God in truth and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any. That was their introduction just before trying to harm Jesus. We know you are truthful. We know you teach the way of God in truth. That's their sneaky, lying introduction before they try to trap Jesus. The Sadducees were priests and very, very liberal. The Pharisees were not priests. They were business people. And they did believe in some of the conservative things. They did believe in life after death. They did believe in the resurrection. They also, the Pharisees, had all these rules. Got to obey all these man-made rules. the Pharisees bring the Herodians along. The Herodians supported Rome. It could be both of them here. The Pharisees didn't like taxes, and the Herodians liked the taxes because they were followers of the Roman Empire, and they would get some of the tax money, so you might have both sides here. Most of the Jewish population did not like Roman taxes. So can we trap Jesus with the Romans, or can we make the general population mad at him? Is he going to support Roman taxes? Is he going to oppose the Romans? What will he do? And he actually separates them. He avoids their challenge by separating them. And the introduction to that next step, verses 17 and 18. Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to give a poll tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus, perceiving their malice, said to them, why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Earlier, we had talked about Baal, and they had Baal coins, and believe it or not, the temple liked the Baal coins. That makes no sense, but they were pure silver, so they liked the Baal coins. The Romans wanted Caesar coins. Introduction to the Caesar coins. They tried to trap Jesus. And let's read a little bit more about these coins and trapping before we make an application. Show me the coin used for the poll tax. And they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. He said to them, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And hearing this, they were amazed. Leaving him, they went away. Show me this coin. Numismatics. We get numismatics from it. Technically, coin collecting is numismatics. And that's what's being referred to here. Show me who's on this coin. It's a picture of Caesar. Well, give Caesar his coins back, but also give to God what is due to God in the temple. The Romans let the Jews make little copper coins, little mites that we call them, translated over into English, but only the Romans could make silver coins. And the Romans did have Caesar's image on it. And Jesus avoided their trap, and they were stunned, and they walked away. This account brings up two topics. We are not on the 4th of July, but it brings up the topic of the separation of God and government, or we say it in English, separation of church and state. A second topic here is a little bit about paying taxes. We'll talk a little about paying taxes, but more on the separation of church and state. The actual founding fathers had the concept of the separation of church and state. The actual words are a little bit later. Madison and Danbury, I think it was a letter I have in my notes, 1804. I didn't look it up, I just did it from memory. But the actual wording of separation, church and state. But the founding fathers did believe in the concept of the separation of church and state. It is biblical here to me, and it was American history. The Old Testament had a lot more merger of religion and law. The law of Moses was supposed to be used by the government. But even then, the priests had to be sons of Aaron. And the kings had to be sons of David. So even then they had different leaders. We have separation of church and state. By that, we meant that the government cannot pick one religion. Or the way we would say it, the government cannot pick one denomination over another. Also, the government should have no laws forcing church attendance, forcing church giving, forcing signing a doctrinal statement. The founding fathers believed very much in the separation of church and state, no one denomination over another, and no laws on, shall we say, church activities. America is different than other countries in this. In Spain, the Catholics. In Scotland, the Presbyterians. In Germany, the Lutherans. In England, the Episcopalians. In Holland, the Dutch Reformed. They are the favored churches. And even now, I think they get money from the government. I sent Angela Merkel the books that we have made, and I got a thank you note back. It said we gave Angela Merkel the books, but it came back from the Department of Churches in Germany, a state system and a state group. We don't have that. We do have chaplains in many government departments and in the military, and chaplains in the Congress. But we do have separation of church and state in funding. And we do have separation of church and state in making people do Christian things, separating the church from laws on attendance, laws on doctrinal statement, laws on giving. Now, separation of church and state is not a separation of ethics into law. Every law will have some ethics. All kinds of ethics are political. In this system, when a majority of people that can decide are Christians, they can put Christian ethics into law. Christian ethics can be passed into law and moral issues, but that's not the same thing as making people go to church, or making people sign a doctrinal statement, or making people give money to churches. That is separated. No required ethical teaching, no required evangelism, don't have to go to this church. No one needs to be forced to do spiritual things. But if there is a legal matter that overlaps with ethics, someone's ethics will be legislated. And where we can with a majority of people, or where we can with a majority of elected people that we elect, we can pass Christian ethics. For example, Christian ethics would have a pattern for marriage. The New Testament is not polygamous, monogamous, just like Adam and Eve. One man, one woman, not really stressing polygamy. So wherever we can pass laws like that, we should pass them. Homosexuality, the death penalty did not go over into the New Testament. There's a lot more graciousness, but the ethics did. So no death penalty, but it's still wrong and should not be a part of a marriage pattern. Killing unborn babies is evil in the Bible. And the strongest thing for it is a little bit indirect, but it's the word pharmakia that we get pharmacy from. There are all these references for pharmacy in the Bible, but it's translated sorcerer because the sorcerers use drugs. The sorcerers use drugs to kill people, potions and so forth. They use drugs for suicide, and they use drugs to do abortion. So every time in the Bible it talks about sorcery is wrong, it is saying abortion is wrong. And in Revelation 22:15 it says, those that are pharmakeioi, that use drugs, or suicide, killing, abortions, these will be outside the heavenly city. So God and government should be separated. Shouldn't be any laws for spiritual activities. Don't have to go to church. Don't have to believe a certain doctrinal statement. Don't have to give any money into church. There should be separation of these things. But regarding ethics, somebody's ethics will be passed into law. Also regarding the government, Romans 13, which Ken read part before us, tells that the government is a minister of God. Sometimes think about that person is a minister of God. Well, the Bible teaches so. Otherwise, I might not think so, but the Bible teaches so. In Romans 2, 14 and 15, it talks about the non-Jews who do not have the law of Moses. They instinctively do things that are in the law. They show the work of the law written in their hearts. So what we might call natural law should be passed into legal law, and if it's a real ethical crime, they should not be allowed to do it. Years ago, I watched the Clarence Thomas hearings. I think it was 1990. And when he was doing his hearings, he talked about natural law. And I thought, well, then he must have learned about natural law, maybe at law school. Natural law is a very common topic. It refers to humans knowing basically right from wrong, and it ought to be made legal. We know when wrong is done to us. We know that's wrong and it shouldn't be done. So Clarence Thomas talked about natural law, and putting that into the legal code is not against the separation of church and state. I'll go ahead and edit. I remember Senator Ted Kennedy saying he had never heard of natural law. And I thought that you didn't go to law school then. You didn't do your homework. You didn't go to a lot of classes. So natural law ought to be made laws of the state, basic right and wrong. But as far as making people go to church, making people sign a doctrinal statement, making people give money to church, that is not a state issue. Pray for them, 1 Timothy 4. Pray for the king, which we don't have. We'd say president. Pray for the governors. Pray that they will be saved. But keep church and state separate, like you have here. Here's Caesar. Here's God. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give to God what is God's. They should be separated. Well, we'll talk a little longer. Do you ever disobey the government? If they have you disobeying a higher law of God, then yes. Pharaoh said, throw the baby boys into the river. The midwives say, no, obey God more than people. Herod told the wise man, you come back and tell me where the baby Jesus is. They did not. God told them to go home another way. If it comes to the point where God says one thing and the government says another, then on that issue, disobey the government and obey God. So they're separated. Use all of our citizenship rights. Paul was a citizen. They were going to beat him. He said, quote, it is not lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman. Use all those citizenship rights. keep the government out of church ministry, keep that separate as far as ethical things go, promote ethics into Christian law. Will the musicians please?